Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir, the only pod that takes you behind the scenes and gives you the inside word on the world of tech and growth from the insiders. I'm Adam Schwab, co-founder of Luxury Escapes, journalist and angel investor, and I'm joined by my great mate, Adir Shiffman, executive chairman of Catapult Sports and serial investor. On today's episode, we talk about the drama at Qantas, the intriguing Step One underwear business, and our big story on inflation, the most significant issue that almost no one seems to understand. And welcome, Adir, back to episode 4 of the pod. It's great to be back. We had a big week.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I continue to be happily surprised by this podcast. What I also like is that you always welcome me, which is nice. It's like we've got a share house together, but every time I come, you're like, welcome. It makes me feel fantastic. So I appreciate that. Well,
it's good. I'm very grateful to have you. I'm getting a lot of incredible feedback, mostly about you. No one's really given me too many compliments, but that's fine. I'm happy to steal
I get the compliments about you. You know what I say to people, by the way, who give me any compliments? I say I'll accept 5% of it because that's the amount of work that I do for this podcast, and the other 95% goes to you. In fact, my parents were listening to the podcast, which is very nice, and I've got – like, my parents are a bit of a problem for me, not for the obvious reason, because they're just these – very supportive, left-wing, progressive kind of parents that think everything that I do is amazing, even though a very large percentage of it is not. And so they listen to it and they tell me how fantastic the podcast is, and they're like so supportive and so loving, but I can't believe a word that they tell me because they're not going to tell me it's appalling. So luckily some people that don't like me have been telling me that it's quite good. So they're my belief. But it's been a lot of fun.
I can speak for you here. We're so grateful to all the feedback we get. I got a lovely message from, we get them all the time. I got a lovely message from a very successful venture capitalist in Sydney who took the time to email his thanks and how much he loved it, someone take the time out of their day to do that. We certainly appreciate it. 4 episodes in, we actually hit number 25 on the top Apple top business charts, which we were, thank you to everybody listening, because obviously that's what it's based on. So a huge thanks to our listeners and to everybody who takes the time to mention it to us.
People said to me, it sounds like you're having a lot of fun, which I thought was like a very honest emotion coming through the microphone, right? Like it's basically just a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
So that's fantastic. What are we talking about? I know, because you always tell me I spend too much time. You know, we're always short of time, so I'm prompting you to get into the first story. So what's the first
story? Keelan's going to have a big couple of days cutting this up, I reckon. I'm going to take 10 minutes out of this. There's been a lot of crap in this, in what we've talked about so far, which we'll just cut up and look beautiful. But our first story this week is the huge Qantas bombshell that was dropped last week, announcing that CEO Alan Joyce would leave his role 2 months early, following a month of absolute turmoil, which culminated in the ACCC launching action in the Federal Court of Australia, alleging that Qantas engaged in false, misleading, or deceptive conduct by advertising tickets for more than 8,000 flights that had already been cancelled but not removed from sale. This came just weeks after the government refused access to Qantas rival Qatar Airlines after Alan Joyce gifted Anthony Albanese's son Chairman's Lounge membership. Not only that, the airline also announced a record $2.5 billion profit, largely on the back of Australian consumers paying sky-high airfares, both domestically and internationally. Adir, do you think Qantas got it wrong moving Alan Joyce 2 months early? And how badly damaged has the Qantas brand been following the absolute drama of the last 2 months?
I don't think Alan Joyce was pushed. Now, I know that's a bit of an unusual view, but I think it was completely his own decision. And so I sent some messages to some friends of mine asking about this question. I told them it was a no-names basis, so we got to keep it no-names. But they're like kind of high flyers in business and journalism. And I asked these friends of mine what they thought, and I'm a bit out on a limb with this particular view, so I'm living up to the contrarian's name of the podcast. One person who I would say would probably the most likely to know what was going on kind of agreed with me and maybe was more nuanced, but I tell you why I think he quit, okay? Firstly, this board has got no history of putting executives under particularly significant amounts of pressure, so why are they going to suddenly fire him now? I mean, 2 months before he finishes. If you look at it from the flip side, which is to look at it from Alan Joyce's perspective, what's the guy got to lose? I mean, basically, he's 2 months out from finishing. He's collected all of his bonuses. If he stays there, the next 2 months are going to be an ACCC nightmare and just daily hate. So the faster he's out of there, the faster the media will move on to hate somebody else. And I think above all, you know, what became obvious is that they needed, you know, this so-called circuit breaker, and it was going to be the chairman or the CEO. And the chairman and the board have been very supportive of Joyce and his executive team. And so I think this could have also potentially been a favour to Goyder to say, I'm going to quit. I'll take the fall. You're not going to have to resign. There's no skin off my back. I'm not really losing anything. And within 6 months, the media and the country will forget that they hate me anyway. So it was actually a pretty smart decision, if you ask me.
I think in most cases, if you're talking about most CEOs, that could be right. I think, and everything he says, as always, is very sensible. I think where there's, I think I might disagree, is just the nature of Alan Joyce. He's a pugnacious fighter. He never gives an inch. He's always, if you remember, go back to 2011 when he grounded the airline, he was public enemy number one. He's probably public enemy number one now again, but he certainly was back in 2011. He grounded the airline. People were stuck in London and all sorts of places because he just decided to ground the airline with no notice. So that was this shows how aggressive.
You mean when he fought the unions on that and he kind of called their bluff?
Yeah, I wrote an article about this today. I think if you go back then, there were people who hated him. There were people who supported. I think the difference between that scenario and now, so in 2011, he grounded the airline on the basis that wages are too high. Qantas was potentially, I don't think it was ever in danger, certainly back then, but there was real questions about the viability of the airline based on its cost base. So the principle was, and this is, I think, the message he took then was, we need to reduce costs to pass on these lower costs to customers. So if you go back to 2011, the main difference was Qantas was acting, in a sense, on behalf of customers, trying to get a better deal for customers. If you look what's happened over the last year, it's been the opposite. It's been Qantas doing everything it can at every possible turn to screw over customers. You've got taking out supply. I think one of the biggest insults to customers was, go back a year ago and Qantas was struggling. There was issues with baggage. There was issues with cancellations. And bear in mind, every airline had these issues. Qantas was far from that. I think Qantas got a really bad run in the media last year, this time last year. I think unfairly so. And I defended Alan Joyce and I defended the Qantas exec at that time because I thought they were unfairly maligned by the press and the consumers. But then what Alan Joyce did was he used that cover. So he used the criticism. He said, okay, I'm going to fix the customer service issues. We're going to take planes out of the air to make it better for customers. That was a complete lie. And B, the only reason they did that was because you know what happens when you take supply out and demand's the same? What happens? You're a good economist.
I agree with you entirely. Like it shut up prices and demand wasn't even the same, right? Demand was sky high at that moment. But I tell where and growing. So I tell where I disagree though. I don't think Qantas is doing everything they can to make life hard for customers. I think that customers do not factor into their decision-making equation. I think that they basically are trying to run an airline in the most profitable way humanly possible, and customers are frustrating and annoying. You know, there was an episode of like Yes Minister back in the day where they complained that the only problem with running a hospital that diminished hospital efficiency was having patients in the hospitals. And like, so they had this hospital that had no patients and they did not want to let patients into the hospital. And I feel like Qantas would be much happier right now if people paid for their tickets but didn't bother to turn up to the airport and didn't bother to get on the plane and didn't ask for refunds. That'd be a much easier airline for them to run. And so, like, that to me is what it feels like as a customer of Qantas at the moment. I tell you what, like, if you're Joyce, you know the South Park, like Cartman is like, screw you, I'm going home. That's what I think he's doing. He's like, what do I need this for? I've taken 35 mil or whatever he's taken out of the airline.
120 mil.
But in the last year, though, or the last year and a half.
I think he's got 24 million still coming. Although that's,
right. Well, he's not going to.
I'd be very surprised if he gets that.
Oh, will you? All right. Let's bet his 24 million that he's going to get it, okay? And he has to pay whichever one of us is right.
I don't really want to pay 24 million.
No, we're going to pay with his 24 million. We're going to take
his. This is what I think. I don't think he gets the 24, and I think Goyder goes within 6 months, possibly within 3 months.
Oh my God. All right. We've got to make a triple headed bet, okay? One is how much is he going to get clawed back? So I'm going to say any clawback would be less than 5 mil. I don't think he's going to get any clawback, by the way. And number two, yep. I think Goyder, what did you say? 6 months or 3 months?
I said between 3 and 6. I think it could be 3, but could also be up to six.
What does between three and six mean? Does it mean if it's two, you lose the bet? Because yes, two is not. Is that really what you're saying?
Give me a 3 to 6 range.
All right. So let's say.
But you're saying he's not going at all, though. So,
yeah, so I'm going to say he's not going.
I should get six or less.
Yeah, well, that's what I would have gone for. You were negotiating against yourself.
I'll take six or less.
Why are you negotiating against yourself? All right,
Vicky Medvec would not be happy. My negotiation coach would not be happy with this at all.
So I'm going to say Joyce is getting all of his money, maybe minus $5 million max, and Goyder's still going to be there in 6 months, and you're going to say the opposite. We'll see how many points each of us gets. Maximum 2 points.
I agree on the clawback. I don't think they're clawing much back. It's very hard to claw back.
All right.
They'll say he earned it. Like almost the most outrageous payment. He got that $6 million for bonuses. Do you remember during COVID when they made that
ridiculous
big song and dance? We're not taking bonuses. We're getting all this. And now he got it anyway. That was just – and this is not – I don't blame Alan Joyce and something for it. This is the Qantas board. What a disgrace they are. You've got a bunch of people who are so ensconced in the chairman's lounge, they don't know what it looks like to get out of this ivory tower. You've got – remember Todd Sampson, the guy, the cool guy from the Gruen transfer that wore the cool T-shirts? He's been on the Qantas board. Like, you'd think – he's a customer guy. You'd think he'd have some sense to fix the. Maybe he's been there too long. Not sure if you know, idea, but Richard Goyder's cousin, a guy called Tim Goyder, has suddenly become a billionaire. He's this big Perth mining guy with a huge stake in Liontown Resources, which is subject to a big $6 billion takeover. Another mining company called Chalice. Ironically, in Perth, Tim Goyder used to be called Little Goyder, and Richard Goyder used to be called Big Goyder, and now that's obviously very much flipped around.
But I think he's Richard done Goyder's- well. He's the chairman of the AFL. He's the chairman of one of the most prestigious businesses in Australia, like one of the, you know, still a leading brand globally as an airline. I think he's done very well.
Well, sorry, he's done very well recently. He's chairman of Woodside, which is a $73 billion
company. That's another good business. Not as popular anymore, but still a good business.
No, but if you look at it, he was the chairman's chairman. He's probably three of the biggest chairman roles. You go back a year, Richard Goyder and Alan Joyce are flying as high as two corporates could be.
Yeah.
And now look at them. Joyce is gone. And remember, the only reason Joyce was sort of fated is because Joyce had this great sword and shield of chairman's lounge. So nobody was wanting to offend him. Either you're in the chairman's lounge and you wouldn't say a word because you'd lose it, or you were not in the chairman's lounge and you wanted to get it. So he had this great protection racket going. Now he's – and then eventually that protection racket just – like Joe Aston basically sliced it away over the past 6 months magnificently.
It would still work on me. I just want to say it would still work on me, that protection
now?
Record. Yeah, if I was in the chairman's lounge, I would only say positive things about Qantas.
About Alan Joyce.
Well, about whatever. I would only say positive things. That's how you know I'm not in the chairman's lounge, because we're having this conversation. Yeah, I'm honest about it. You can buy me for a chairman's lounge membership. I think it's very effective.
Maybe you'll get one. You're being so positive about them.
Politicians should not be permitted to take chairman's lounge membership.
Absolutely.
You agree with that, right?
100% they should. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. That's just a... And I think we should quickly talk about, before we move on to the next topic, the ACCC action is just a... Congratulations to Gina Cass Gottlieb for taking this action, because it's a big move by her. It's her first really big move as ACCC chair. So that's a fantastic effort by her and the ACCC team. But this is a big scalp, and it looks like Qantas is about to lie down, and I'm pretty sure we'll settle. But this is just an absolutely outrageous, and it's so insidious. So I think everybody got a lot of cancellation sympathy for what Qantas was going through last year, the cancellations. I think one in four flights was cancelled. Mm-hmm. It was really hard. Running an airline last year and the last 3 years is really hard. Everybody's got sympathy for that. What we don't have sympathy for was just the outrageous actions of that cancel a flight and not tell customers for up to 8 weeks. And what's happening in that time is customers for airlines are highly dynamic pricing. As you get closer to the departure date, the price can increase 2, 3, 4-fold. Mm-hmm. So a customer could have paid $8,000 for a ticket to LA, and then Qantas cancels it 8 weeks later, doesn't put them on a new plane. The person has to pay. The person's going to see family or friends or whatever. That person has to pay $20,000 for a ticket to replace what they'd already bought, and often that's with Qantas. So Qantas is just gouging people through their own ineptitude.
So the accusation is basically that they kept selling tickets on cancelled flights. And my view of that is it's probably true.
I think they admitted it. I don't think there's any...
Oh, they admitted it. There you go. There you go. So I'm one out of one. Tick that box. And but I think that, you know, there's this... I can't remember. It's someone's razor or someone's axiom or something or other, which is never attribute to malice what can be explained by incompetence. I can't remember whose razor that is. It's very good. I totally agree with it. I reckon we'll find out that Qantas was basically incompetent in reselling these tickets, and it will not end up being malicious. Or maybe somebody knew about it, it was a nightmare to fix it, and they kind of just rolled with it. It would surprise me if this was a deliberate strategy by Qantas. However,
I think it's more willful blindness. I think
it could
like
be.
If you get drunk and get behind a car wheel. Well, you didn't intend to kill somebody, but you basically did everything you could to.
Well, it might be more, you know, someone is getting into a car drunk and it's going to be a nightmare to solve that problem. And so you just look the other way. I think it's more like that. But I definitely think this idea that Qantas will leave you like completely in the lurch when you've booked a ticket with them and say, we're cancelling the flight. Too bad, because we don't want to take the revenue hit on the ticket that we can sell for 3 times the price. If that turns out to be true, that to me is where the punishment should be. And I just want to say this about airlines. Don't you wonder why Virgin and Rex have not taken more advantage of this situation? Like, I like Rex. Do you fly Rex?
I haven't. I've heard good things about Rex.
You haven't flown Rex?
No, I'm also very loyal to Virgin now.
Yeah, you got it. All right, there you go. See, I've got the chairman's lounge that I'm angling for with my comments, and you've got Virgin that you got a spruik. But I'll tell you, I fly Rex. Let me tell you about Rex, okay? Like, they're unbelievably friendly, the staff. I think because they're, like, a lot of them are based in regional Australia, so really friendly. The food is actually pretty decent. It's never delayed, never, let alone cancelled. I've never had a delay. They leased a heap of the old Virgin planes when Virgin restructured. So they're literally flying Virgin planes. You can say old Virgin planes, but they're not especially old. They're perfectly nice. And they're cheap. Like, it's just a great all-round experience. I'm surprised that Rex is not making more noise about give us a try. They're not very good at marketing, Rex.
I think there could be some capacity issues there. I'm not sure they can actually take that many more.
They can take a lot more. They're losing money. Whatever they can take more. They need to make money. Let me just tell you one funny thing about Rex and we'll move on. So when they took the planes from Virgin, they had Economy X, you know, which is the leg room at the front of the plane and in the exit row. And then they said, we're just going to leave it called Economy X. And Virgin said, you got to get rid of the Economy X. That's our trademark. And Rex looked and they said, ooh, Virgin never registered the trademark. So they tried to register the trademark. This is true. And it went to court. Can you believe it went to court? And the judge was basically said to Rex and to their counsel, I think you need to reread the whole trademark law. Like, you don't have to lodge a trademark. They used it before you and they were using it anyway. And then so it was thrown out and eventually Virgin trademarked Economy X. But, you know, that is pugnacious. You want to know what's taking it to the enemy. Yeah. That's impressive. I mean, it's a waste of legal fees, but still, that's impressive.
I should say, I've been criticising Qantas a bit this segment. I was in the US last January and we travelled domestically a few times in the US. Even Qantas, Virgin, Rex, at their absolute worst during peak COVID, was still significantly better than any kind of domestic flying in the US. Flying, and you probably do a lot more than me, is just a hellhole. Makes Jetstar look like Singapore Airlines. It is so bad. And we're a bit spoiled in Australia because Qantas, Virgin, Rex, they're all excellent airlines, generally great customer service, especially now. Obviously, we criticised Qantas for what happened last year, but we are very spoiled by how good our domestic airlines are.
Oh, Virgin America used to be really good back in the day, like really nice. And then Alaska bought it and then that was the end of that. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. I completely agree with you.
And we'll be back in a few moments after a quick word from our sponsor.
Adam, I assume you've claimed the R&D tax incentive at some point.
Oh, it's the best thing I do all year.
That's very positive. Well, I also think it's fantastic. I mean, it pays back up to 43.5% of genuine R&D, and you can get a cash payment as well as a tax incentive. But the problem that I found is the process potentially can be a nightmare to manage.
Not only that, if you do it wrong, you actually get a really big fine from the tax office. So it's something that you want to be really careful with.
Agree. I mean, compliance is challenging. But the good news is our friends at Rimon Advisory specialize in managing the entire process and can also help claim everything that you're entitled to. They've been doing it for 12 years. I can say that I honestly actually use them for my startups, and their co-MD, Lior Steen, is really responsive in my experience. So you should go to their website, Rimon, that's rimon.com.au, where you can learn more, use their free calculators, and drop them a line. Now it's back to the contrarians.
And for our next story is a really intriguing Australian business that caught our eye recently, a business called Step One, which listed on the ASX in November 2021, this is in the middle of the COVID asset boom when everything was super expensive. Step one is a direct-to-consumer brand which sells organically grown and certified sustainable manufactured innerwear, which is effectively underwear made, I think, from bamboo. Step one's share price peaked at $3 a share shortly after listing, giving the business a valuation of more than $500 million, and then dropped 90% to hit 22 cents a share just a year later. The share price has since rebounded to 64 cents, and the business now has a market cap of around $120 million. But the business saw revenue drop 10% last year to $65 million. But the good news is it did generate $12 million in EBITDA, up from a loss of $300,000 last year, and also reported NPAT, so net profit after tax, of $8 million. So this thing is a genuine business. Another bright spot was returning customers improved year on year. But one thing that was concerning was new customers were down 31% on the back of lower ad spend. So we see some really mixed signals here. So Adir, what are your thoughts on this business?
So I looked at this business. I mean, I was a total moron when this business IPO'd. In fairness, it IPO'd for like $500 million or $300 million or whatever it was, right? So I kind of gave it a bit of short shrift because it just seemed a bit ridiculous to me. But yeah, actually, I was a bit of a moron because this is quite an interesting business when you really look at it. And what happened to this business in the last 12 months, and the reason like it plummeted, is because like their numbers looked pretty bad and they downgraded and there were all of these kind of issues with it. But a lot of that was, you know, they had $4 million basically of IPO-related expenses to float the business on the ASX. And so that ate into it, and there were some other things as well. And when you really look at this business, because they just reported, I think they're actually a pretty nice direct-to-consumer business. The headline for them is revenue down in Australia, revenue down in America, which has gotten basically no revenue, revenue down in the UK. It looks very bad. But if you actually analyse this business, like they generated $65 million selling underwear, which is pretty unbelievable. All I think it's all sold online on Amazon and on their own websites.
Yep.
And we spoke about gross profit last week. You know what their gross profit is?
It's 80% margin.
It's 80%. So they sell something for $20. And it basically costs them $4.
I think the caveat to that is, I think there's a couple of caveats there. One, and clearly this is a very ideal business, this one, direct to consumer, own the product. Well, they get a contract manufacturer, but essentially own the product.
It's their product, yeah. That's their differentiator, right? It's very popular.
I'm not sure
online.
Is there any real competitive advantage in what they produce? I wouldn't have thought
it's
that hard.
No, there's competitors that do. Like what looks to me when I look online, it looks very similar. I will say their reviews are very good online.
Yep.
People love their product.
I'm wearing them right now. And I think they were good. I bought it off Amazon, I think, on Prime Day, so it was a fraction of the usual cost. They wouldn't have made 80% margin.
Well, they probably still made 50% margin.
What'd
you pay? I think they're $20
Not
underwear.
Through Amazon. Not given what they're paying Amazon a clip as well.
That's true.
So 80% is true. I think the other issue is, yeah, you're right on 80% margin, but the marketing costs about 50% of the margin.
So,
if you look at contribution margin,
yes.
Why don't we talk about contribution margin for a second?
I agree. So the way I kind of break these businesses down is I say, what's the gross profit? Okay, 81% for them. Virtually the same as last year, which is impressive, by the way.
Mm.
And then what I say is then they have to kind of bring it in and send it out to the customer and they've got some transaction fees. And then they're left with 65%, which is a bit worse than last year, but it's still, I would rather 70%, to be honest, but it's pretty good. I'll tell you one thing that was interesting before we get to marketing. The transaction fees as a percentage of their revenue rose from 2.6% to 3.4%. That's like basically for charging credit cards, Shopify Plus, whatever it is. Has that been your experience, that this big rise in merchant transaction fees or not in the last 12 months?
No. We've been relatively consistent, I think. And obviously, US is a much, you pay them a lot more in the US.
But they have nothing. They have nothing in the US. They do like $1 million or $2 million of revenue in the US.
It doesn't make sense.
It's Australia, UK.
Australia, 3.5% Afterpay maybe?
Yeah.
But I can't imagine Afterpaying bamboo underwear.
Well, they're pretty expensive. But like, so the thing is, I did notice for Temple and Webster that they had an increase. I think my recollection is they also had an increase in their transaction fees that was quite significant. So there might be something going on here that, because, you know, Shopify Plus, you can't really negotiate much with Shopify Plus on transaction fees. You got to just suck it up pretty much.
Well, people, there's a lot of business founders, VCs who listen to the show. Why don't you email us directly and let us know what you're paying on merchant fees and has it gone up or down? We'll report back. Hopefully we'll get some good feedback from the source.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. So you end up with this 65% of delivered margin and then you got marketing, okay? That's how I break it down. And so I tell you what's interesting. They market in Australia, they market in the UK, and they've got a bit of the US, but the US is basically a nothing business, so forget about that. And last year, their marketing was 45% of their revenue. And this year, it was 36% of their revenue. And it came down in both Australia and the UK. And there's some interesting so that's way too high, okay, in my view. Like I don't want more than 20% to be the marketing expenditure for a business like this. So it's way too high. But there's some interesting things about the fact that it came down. One is that you will hate. I'm going to tell you something that I know you're going to hate.
Yeah.
Almost all of their spend is digital, online.
Yeah.
So there's just almost no brand building that's going on with this business, and that's very problematic. And the other thing that I really don't like about, because there's a lot of things I like about this business. I'll tell you what I especially like in a second, but this is actually not too bad what I'm saying so far, but what I don't like is this. The average customer spends $90 on an average order, so they buy four pairs of underwear.
Yeah.
But almost all of that is profit, right? The gross margin is great. But the cost of acquiring that customer means that the first order is not going to be profitable. Mm. And so I am allergic to direct-to-consumer businesses that lose money on the first order at the contribution line, which is after everything except before fixed costs, because it means the faster you grow new customers, the faster you burn cash. And then you have to use these metrics like lifetime value, which means let's try and make up how many times we think the customer is going to buy over the course of the life with the business. And you know, we just roll dice for those kind of numbers, right? So it's a random number generator. So I think that's an issue with this business.
I hate D2C business. I hate any consumer business that's not at least break even off first purchase. I can live with break even. I hate losing money because the exception being obviously a SaaS business, a subscription business, that's obviously fine because you assume that the lifetime is more than, call it, 1 month.
SaaS is okay to lose money with a high revenue growth rate, high gross margins and low churn. If you've got low those
churn.
Three things,
it's all about churn.
You can lose money for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm talking about sort of call it the first month. But absolutely. If you're paying more, and so you've got a combination of effectively negative unit economics, so you're losing money off the first purchase, and then you've got no real competitive advantage because I'm not locked into buying. I bought Step One. I haven't bought them since. They're absolutely fine. But if I got served, and Amazon are more than likely to serve me another brand because the other brand, Amazon's now essentially a $43 billion media business now, $43 billion, I should say, media business. If Amazon served me Step Two and it's exactly the same thing and it's a dollar less, I'm going to buy Step Two. I've got no loyalty to Step One.
Why not?
Like, why don't I?
Yeah, because you said you bought them and you really like them. And, you know, without going into too much personal detail here, underwear for men is like, you want a good fit. It's not easy to find a good fit. It's quite personal. I don't know, maybe it's easier for you. I can't find it. I can't walk into a shop and buy anything for a good fit. It is so hard for me to buy clothes.
Whether it's on special, whether it's Calvin Klein or whether it's Bonds, I tend to be pretty equal opportunity underwear buyer. I'm not overly pedantic about the brand. I'll buy whatever's sort of, I think, on special. And if it's usually expensive and it's on half price, I'll generally buy it.
I see. They'll get you on that. Well, so I think part of the problem with this is that they can't, they're not spending enough on branding. And so nobody knows, there's nothing aspirational about, I know it sounds bullshit to say, oh, there's aspirational underwear, but it is true. Like there's nothing aspirational about the brand.
Absolutely.
Their sustainability credentials seem pretty good to me, to be honest. So there is something in the brand here that they've got. I don't think they do a great job of it. I think the problem with running like what you called negative unit economics on the first purchase basically is that you're going to, unless you have lots and lots and lots of repeat purchases, you're going to end up needing to raise capital in order to keep growing. But these guys don't need to do that. So that's what's interesting about this business. What's interesting is, maybe I'll go back a step and say, you talked about contribution margin, which is how much am I making on a sale before I pay my fixed costs and not lying about my fixed costs. Because lots of people lie to themselves about their fixed costs. Oh, there's a fixed cost that won't go up. But it's not really a fixed cost. It's a stepped cost, right? It has to go up as your revenue goes up. It just doesn't go up, you know, perfectly proportionally. And so, so there are so many companies that like build it and they will come companies that really should not be losing money to build a brand because their unit economics are not good enough to justify losing money. And this would be, in my view, one of those businesses. But the good news is they don't lose money. Like, so there, I produce a number that I call cash EBIT, which is kind of like, before you pay tax, what's the closest proxy I can get to how much money this business really makes? I reckon they made like close to $11 million, which is like 17%. And the year before, they made a 15% margin. And so, and they generate free cash and they're paying a dividend. Like, and so, it's a low growth business in my view. Like, I think it's going to be hard to...
shrunk, actually. No, it's shrunk because they reduce marketing.
But. Yeah, yeah. And like, but I think in the future, they'd have to pull a bit of a rabbit out of the hat to really ramp growth. But I might be wrong. But this is what I think about this company, which is not investment advice. But you tell me what you think about this, okay? So the business is worth ballpark 100 mil. How much cash do you think they have on the balance sheet?
I think I checked this was a 35.
Yeah, they got $38 million of cash.
Yeah.
It's close enough, 35, I'll give you that. Yep. So they got 38 mil. And then if you look at the way I look at their inventory when I look at a balance sheet, because you've got to value it at something, is I just say, whatever they're carrying the value on the balance sheet, halve it.
Yeah.
And so what it would mean for them is that, you know, the $20 underwear would be effectively selling it for $2. If you had to clear it at half the price. So I reckon that's fair enough, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so if you go and kind of sanitize out their balance sheet and say, what are they really looking at in terms of cash and some other assets they can liquidate? I reckon there's got to be 20 cents of cash on a 60 cent share sitting on the cash and liquidatable inventory minus some payables. I mean, so that starts changing. So because when people look at the price of a public company, they say, oh, like what's the price to earnings, right? Like what's the value of the company relative to the earnings of the business? And often they'll look at net profit as an answer.
Mm.
But I think it's more interesting to say, get rid of net out cash-free, debt-free on the balance sheet.
We've got like, enterprise value.
Enterprise value, equity value. Exactly. And then look at the cash EBIT value and work out a multiple of that. And I reckon this business today is trading on like 7 times its cash EBIT.
I was going to say, it's about 6 times almost. So
I
agree. I think it's, remember, it did shrink last year. So we're talking about multiples.
Oh, boo-hoo. Like they were invented in 2019 or something.
Well, all the more reason they shouldn't be shrinking. Ultimately, we talk about these big multiples, 10, 12, 15, 20, 30 times multiples or revenue multiples.
Well, no one's paying
That's based on huge revenue growth, though. If the business isn't, forget shrinking, not growing, then you get a multiple of like 3 or 4 times in the old days. Or if you're a unlisted sort of illiquid
fish
business.
Fish and chip store.
Yeah, 2 times.
Yeah,
so
2 times.
Even when we talk about 6 times for a business that's not growing fast is actually probably a pretty... I actually think this business is pretty fairly valued, to be honest. I don't hate it. I think it makes money. I don't think it's got any competitive advantage, which I don't like. It loses money on first. It's got 63% repeat purchases, so it's not... There's things to like about it. There's things not to like about it. 60 million EV is probably not that far off.
So if I
think the market's got this right.
So if I was buying this in the private... So I tell you what, the one thing... I'll tell you what I would pay for this in a private market, but let me tell you the thing that a bit of a different way to look at valuation. So they're going to pay 5 cents of a fully franked dividend. And so that means, you know, 30% tax has already been paid on that 5 cents, just to explain what that means. I know you know what that means. And so like when you look at that, I mean, that's like a 8-9% fully franked yield, as well as maybe you'll get growth, maybe not. By the way, of the $9 million or something that they're paying, 6 of it goes to the founder. Like, he still owns 2/3 of the company.
Yeah.
And like another few percent.
And we love founder-led companies.
Oh,
so
I'm not disparaging it. Like, imagine a guy that can float
generally.
A company at 300 mil and he owns close enough to 100% before he sells down.
I think Greg Taylor, his name is.
Yeah. So I tell you what I would pay in a private market. I'd pay 4 times earnings for this business in a private market. And then I would use it as a platform to diversify the product range, and I would shift tons of marketing to, I'd do more brand marketing.
Absolutely.
And I think this would be a great buy in the private market at 4x cash EBIT. In a public market at 6 or 7, I agree with you. Like, it feels about right. I wish I would have bought it at 22 cents. I don't know. Yeah. I wasn't even paying attention. It was cash. Yeah. It was selling for cash.
This was December last year when nobody was looking at anything, in fairness. I think you're right. I think if they can put some really good Mark Wahlberg in some step ones and put them on out of home everywhere, I think that kind of thing works. That's what Calvin Klein did. 100%. This is a business that absolutely needs to build a brand. And building brands hard and risky, right? Because,
yeah,
what I say, 50% of marketing works, 50% doesn't. We just don't know which works and what doesn't. So that's the challenge. And I'm guessing they're a digital native business, probably never done above the line, don't understand it, don't want to risk it. So there's plenty of reasons not. We all go through this quandary. But I think absolutely you're right. I think your analysis is spot on here, and wish the guys at Step One well, because they look like a great Australian business that's done a great job and is taking bamboo underwear to the world.
They can get Mark Wahlberg, by the way, because his F-45.
His
F-45 commitments are not going to be keeping him busy anymore.
Not.
Is he litigating F-45 or not?
I think that business is worth about $15 million now. I used to go to F-45. I used to go to the Port Melbourne F-45, which was, I think, the biggest. It was owned by a couple of footballers. It was the biggest F-45 in Australia, probably one of the biggest in the world.
Really?
And such is the decline of F-45, that actually shut that gym. So many people, you couldn't get in. You'd rock up there at 6 a.m. and the people were, there'd be 100 people crammed in there, and they shut it. It's such as the downfall.
What
of that
are you
business.
Doing at F-45? You run and ride like 2,000 kilometres a week. What do you need F-45 for? What do you think happened?
This is F-45 was super hot. It was actually really good fun going there.
So you went there for personal branding, basically.
My wife both went there. It was not the same time because we had kids at home. But yeah, we'd go one after the other. We'd go and we'd rush and try and make it in between classes.
And what do you think happened to really that sad. Business? What do you think? I know it's that topic.
We talked about it a second ago. That I don't like commoditised businesses that are easily copied. And there was about 100 imitators, Body Fit, and all these other imitators came up, and they did this. Remember, I think F-45 tried to sue a couple of them, but the notion of group fitness with a screen to tell you what to do is hardly a novel concept, and everybody just copied it, charged less, and then other stuff. It's like a nightclub. They were the cool nightclub, and nightclubs could come in and out of fashion, and then another cool nightclub opened around the corner. All the good-looking guys and girls went to that new nightclub. Suddenly the old nightclub didn't have any good-looking people there, so nobody goes. And that's essentially the story of F-45.
That's interesting. And, you know, like when you talked about, because I'm going to just pick up on this because you gave Mark Wahlberg as an example. The thing I couldn't work out about Step One is who the customer is. Like, is the customer you? Because I just did a women's range. That's one of the things that's boosted, you know, their performance, which is really good. Like diversifying beyond your halo product is not easy on direct-to-consumer. Yeah, exactly, product-led growth. But, like, I can't work out if you're meant to be their customer or if a 20-year-old is meant to be their customer.
As you know, I'm a millennial by a couple of weeks, I think.
I've heard that somewhere before, by the way.
I would think I think Keelan would be that customer as well. Keelan looks about, he's about sort of 25 or something. How old are you?
Keelan's our producer.
I'm 23.
Keelan's banging now. Do you buy Step One, Keelan? Are you a customer?
No, I actually buy from their competitor, Nobby.
Nobby.
There you go. We'll come competitor. So
that's
we've got a classic
name.
Case.
That's a better name. Nobby is a better name than Step One.
Well, this is exactly why I actually am a bit bearish on the business, that Keelan's buying the competitor. The coolest guy on the show here, of the three of us, is the 23-year-old going to the good nightclubs and we're staying at home.
Who you call 25. By the way, when you're 23, 25 is very different to 23. I mean, when you're in your 40s, it's not. But, like, you wouldn't know. But, like, when you're...
Keelan, for that.
And so one more question to Keelan. So are they cheaper than Step One? What do you pay for a pair?
I don't think so. They're about $20 a pair, but... Each pair comes with, like, a... great design, like a unique design on every pair.
A unique design on every pair. How the hell does the economics work on that?
Sorry, not on every pair, on every like release. Sorry.
Oh, they've got the daily drops. You know about that, Adam? These drops.
Once a month, they release a new.
Yes, that's very smart. You know these drops. These businesses that go and it's very smart. They go and design a limited edition. And
well, the shoe company started that, didn't they?
I think maybe a women's bag company started it. You might be right.
Okay.
You might be right. One like it was about the same time, I think.
Yeah.
And so a lot of like direct-to-consumer retailers now have this thing where either they do like surprise drops or they say every Thursday or every second Thursday there's going to be a new product. And it's a pretty interesting way to drive revenue jumps. It's pretty interesting.
I know of a business called Luxury Escapes that drops a new holiday every day. So I wouldn't say it's a brand new concept, but
every day.
But anyway, it's a good concept. Every day, check it out.
Lucky Scope. Groupon. This is a Groupon model.
It is the Groupon model, in a way. I think we're obviously taking it to a new level. But, Groupon, and it's a sad story of Groupon. Before we go to the next story, Groupon was worth $26 billion at one point. I think it's about $200 million now. So that's a business that unfortunately didn't quite live up to its initial hype.
How much do you reckon it raised? How much did it raise?
I don't know.
A lot more than $200 million.
It'd be...
billions.
I don't think it'd be in the billion. I don't think it'd be that many. Reckon? I don't think it may be in the billions. We'll look it up and I'll come back to you next week. And we'll be back in a few moments after a quick word from our sponsors. So, Adir, what do you think of financial planning?
I think it's poorly understood and I think it's heavily underutilized.
I couldn't agree more. There are so many bankers, lawyers, doctors, really smart people who simply don't know how to manage their money. What do you think?
I agree. I'm definitely better at making money than managing money, absolutely.
I think that's the case with most people. And a great solution to that is Bowden Financial. Bowden works with high-income professionals and successful business owners to build a comprehensive wealth management plan. They specialise in family succession planning. Bowden Financial are great supporters of the Contrarians podcast. Bowden are supporting our podcast with a special offer for our listeners, a two-hour free expert consultation with the Bowden team where they will assess your personal needs and see what they can do to help. Take advantage of this great offer. Call 02-4937-0270. Or go to bowdenfinancial.com.au. Now, back to the pod. Last week, at Phil Lowe's final board meeting, the RBA left interest rates on hold for a third consecutive month. We should actually just compare this to the US, which has been much harsher than the RBA in terms of raising interest rates. So the Fed raised interest rates to a 22-year high in July. It was their 11th rate rise in 17 months. And just to compare, in the US, interest rates, so the benchmark interest rate is 5.25%. Obviously, as a mortgage holder, you pay a couple percent more. In Australia, it's 4.1, so much lower. And US inflation rate is down to 3%. So US has gotten further ahead than Australia in inflation, 3%. We're still at sort of almost around 5%, which is actually really high when you think sort of it's compounding at 5%. I wrote an article about this last week, just talking about this, the cause of inflation. And in my view, inflation was really caused by governments going crazy during COVID and just printing so much money and central banks keeping interest rates so low for so long. But Adir, what are your take on inflation and what's the causes and how long is it here to stay for?
I mean, people feel like it's such a boring topic and it's so confusing and there's so many acronyms and there's so many numbers. But I think the way that you explain it is very good. I'm just going to say, which is inflation means there's too much money sloshing around in an economy and we've got to do something about it, because if we don't, it makes people behave in crazy ways. Like they get poorer, they start putting up wages, which creates this horrible cycle of like the inflation wage cycle. They start buying things like crazy the minute they think there's inflation, because they're worried the prices are going to go up. And so, you know, there's this idea of jawboning, which means if you say that there's inflation, it creates inflation. Yeah. And so then you got, what the hell do you do about it? And it kind of is a bit slightly more sophisticated than when they used to have witch doctors doing rain dances, hoping that it would. It's a bit more sophisticated. But really, you do things and then you don't know if they're going to work and how long they're going to take to work. And just to summarize that, I think, you know, the way that you would say it, I guess, is the two things that we know that might dry up the money supply. Basically, you're trying to dry up the money supply.
Yep.
So what you're trying to do is take money off people. That's what you're trying to do. Like, absolutely. Nobody wants to say it. No politician's ever going to say that. What you're trying to do is, I got to get some of your money back. And so the ways you can do it are make interest rates go up, because then people have to pay more interest on their debts.
Yep.
And that gives them less money to spend.
And they also don't invest as much, because what's called a hurdle rate becomes higher. Because right. If you can get more... It actually changes. So if you've got a low interest rate, there's no point, or if you've got a negative interest rate, which happened in Europe in the last few years, there's no point leaving money in the bank, because you're losing money compared to inflation in real terms. So if your interest rates are 1% and inflation's 5%, every year you're losing 4%, you're better off spending that
money. You're under pressure to invest.
So that's why people go and spend.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's not just the debt payments, it also just encourages people to save versus spend.
And the other thing that makes people have less money is losing their jobs. And no one ever wants to talk about that. But in the history of economics, as far... By the way, you know, I've never done like a business degree or an economics degree. So you correct me.
You're a doctor. Doctor,
I believe. What I'm talking about, So, but as far as I've ever researched and understood, no inflation has ever been tamed from high numbers without the unemployment rate rising. Like, you got to take money off people by losing jobs. Just, it's horrible. And then no one wants to talk about it. And then the worst thing that you can do is the government goes and hands out more money to people when there's high inflation.
Just on that, and there's a common trope in the business most business commentators aren't very smart, and that's problematic. So you read the business pages and you get the odd very good person in the AFR and Fairfax, but many of them just don't have a clue what they're talking about. So that you
would
see
you
this.
Would you ever say that there was a good person in news at The Australian, or you fundamentally refuse to concede
that
Murdoch could have good journalists?
No, I think Murdoch's got some good journalists. Okay. No, I've written for The Australian. Yeah.
Well, that means there's one.
But no, I think The Australian's got some good journalists. And even the Herald Sun and some of the sort of tabloid papers have some good journals as well.
I don't
want to
sidetrack you. Keep going.
Yeah,
keep
but going. I think if you look at
I'm just trying to pick fights with you, basically.
We need more fights.
Yeah, I'm trying. We're not even agreeable people.
We're called the contrarians.
We're not even agreeable.
Yeah.
But here we're agreeable.
Yeah, we disagree with everyone else. We agree with each other. What a lot of business commentators say in the last couple of years is, "Oh, we can't have interest rates too high because we'll have a recession." As if the recession is the worst thing in the world. We can't have a recession. Mm. Well. Depression's pretty bad. So if you go back to 1930, depression's quite bad. We have 30% unemployment. And that's terrible. And normal, let's call it a recession, which should happen every 10 years. Let's say you have unemployment of 5%. Mm. And unemployment goes to, and technically a recession's two periods of negative growth. So it's actually a really low bar.
Negative growth in like human being talk means shrinking.
Negative growth is, I won't talk about the definition of what they call economic growth, but basically it's consumer spending and investment spending.
Going
basically.
Down, because there's negative growth means shrinking.
Yeah.
It's so just a fact, like you could just use one word, shrink. Now, I'm not blaming you, but like they don't want to say shrinking, so they choose two words, negative growth.
Shrinking is right. So basically people are spending less for two consecutive quarters. I think it's two consecutive quarters, not months.
Yeah, quarters, correct.
Yeah, so it was kind of a recession, but ultimately if you go from 5% unemployment to 7% unemployment, that's 2% of the working population, which is only 67% of the population. So a small percentage of people, reasonably high number, but a small percentage have a significantly worse standard of living because you go from having a job to not having a job, which is bad.
Absolutely.
But compare that to inflation, where it's bad for like 95% of it. So the really rich people benefit from inflation because they got more money and their assets are going up faster than the inflation rate, so they're fine. So the price of yachts and art and all that stuff goes up faster than inflation. So rich people are fine in periods of inflation. Anybody who's not rich, it's bad. If you're really poor, it's really bad because stuff like basic staples goes up significantly and you can't afford to pay for it. So not everybody works. You got pensioners. You got people who aren't working. So for the 2% of people who lose their job in that, call it recession, it's really bad. But for everybody else, it's not so bad because if you got a recession, you got prices not going up, your standard of living actually increases because in periods of deflation, and economists hate deflation. So deflation is the opposite of inflation. Mm-hmm. Deflation is prices dropping. So economists, again, this is another massive problem from business commentators not knowing what they're talking about. So people go, we can't have deflation. Deflation's the worst. People claim deflation's worse than inflation on the basis that if you see prices dropping, this is the claim, people hold off on spending and that leads to a downward spiral. So if you think, oh, I'm not going to take this holiday that costs $1,000 because next year it's going to be $950, they think, oh, that's bad. People will stop spending. People lose jobs and it creates a downward spiral. In reality, that's completely not the case because you know what happens in electronics every year? There's deflation. The price of a phone drops. The price of a TV. The price of TVs have dropped.
The price of the iPhone is not dropping. No, I just paid $2,000 for an iPhone.
No, but if you bought an iPhone, the same type of... That's because you're getting better specs. If you bought the same spec of iPhone, it drops. If you bought a 43-inch TV now, it's like 95% less.
Right, but that's fine. But I can tell you, I've not been paying $2,000 for an iPhone previously. I mean, in the good old days, it was subsidized by the phone company.
Yeah.
But 2000, like, I get what you're saying, but... Definitely, I don't agree with that comment about it. Like, I think it's absurd that I just paid $2,000.
Let's take out iPhones because Apple's got significant market power. But TVs, for example, computers, even a better example, have dropped consistently over 30 years in price, like consistently drop in price. Has anybody stopped buying computers because of deflation of computing? I don't think anybody's, not one single person.
All right, but if you're going to buy something that's a discretionary purchase, like a sofa, and there's, I'm going to be extreme, 10% deflation, you might hold off on buying that.
But if you need a sofa, I bought a sofa 2 weeks ago. We needed to because the spring was in through our back. I couldn't hold that off.
But most people are not waiting for the springs to go through their backsides.
Some people are frugal than the average person.
And they're not sitting on the floor. What they're saying is, this sofa's 4 years old. Maybe it's a bit tattered. I'll get a new one. Well, deflation will stop you buying in that situation.
Maybe those highly incremental purchases. But in most cases, anyway, digress on the disinflation point. But it's a point that isn't well understood. But neither over, and the article I wrote for Crikey last week, because Crikey had been basically saying, and Crikey has a certain political persuasion, I don't agree with sort of everyone who writes, most people who write for Crikey, but I'm sort of the contrarian in that room as well.
Far left, is that what you mean?
I wouldn't say it's far left, but it's certainly gone when Stephen Mayne started Crikey, it was really centrist. It was really contrarian in many ways. And it has drifted further and further left over the years. And that's where the audience has gone. And they've increased their subscriber base significantly. But as a result, it's gone further left.
And like the Guardian kind of position.
Probably further left than the Guardian now.
I would say the Guardian is quite far left. Yeah. Crikey is further left, but you don't think Crikey is far left. Well, I'm a centrist. Everyone hates me equally.
Yeah, I'm a centrist as well. And so I've been writing for Crikey for 20... I've written 1,000 articles for Crikey. I was probably right in the middle initially, or maybe... slightly right for Crikey, but I consider myself probably centre-left in most issues. Yet I'm the far-right extremist in the Crikey stable. Everybody else is sort of left or far-left. So it's sort of gone...
It kind of does feel like that when you read the articles.
Yeah, but what you read other Crikey commerce saying is, in regards to inflation, inflation's been caused by corporations increasing their prices. And there's an element... Well, that is technically true. Corporations have increased their prices. The reason corporations can increase their prices is because people have more money to spend on stuff.
That's
if people didn't have more money, businesses couldn't. And the exception to that is monopolies and oligopolies. So if you look at Qantas, for example, Qantas ripped a bunch of planes out of the air, and a lot of people have to fly Qantas because they've got loyalty status, or the business makes them fly Qantas or whatnot. Mm. So if Qantas rips a bunch of planes out of the air, reduces their supply, then Alan Joyce increases the price on everything else. Suddenly, you have to fly Qantas and you have to pay more. Yep. That is an example of corporations being, called inverted commas, greedy. Mm-hmm. And Qantas are arguably smart to do that, although they're now about to cop some backfire from the ACCC. And energy companies are the same. They have this whole energy transition. Suddenly, energy companies massively increase the price of energy, whereas the actual inputs in energy have actually dropped back to what they were pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. So that's why Origin announced a record profit last week and AGL's profiting. So yes, in a monopoly situation, we have seen some absolute greed, but I'll take a real life example. So I went to the hairdresser last week, so I got a haircut, which you can see right here.
It looks
here.
Good. I didn't want to comment on it because it would, you know, maybe age the podcast after you go bald and stuff. But
one thing I don't think is ever going to happen to me is go bald.
No, you've got a great head of hair. Good, I agree.
You know, I've digressed from the topic, but I was getting a haircut and I go to a hairdresser and I was actually booking the haircut online and I saw that they've got one really good, there's I think about 8 or 9 hairdressers in this, it's a very popular barbershop. And there's one guy who, younger guy, and he's, I remember when I started going to him, I thought this guy's a really good hairdresser. Mm. And he clearly other people thought the same. So people really want to go to him now. His name's Elliot, really good guy. And Elliot, I just saw, now charges a $10 premium. Mm. Everybody else charges, this is on Saturday, $50, and Elliot's $60. It's a bit cheaper during the week. Pre-COVID, it was about $35. So Elliot's haircut's gone from $35 to $60. He's still booking out. Mm. So Elliot, in the eyes of some of these sort of far left commentators, Elliot's the cause of inflation because he's put his price up. Elliot's put his price up because he's really good at hairdresser and people have more money. So Elliot should be putting his price up. So why shouldn't the best hairdresser charge like the best doctor or whatever it is? Because you pay more to go to the best, and he should be, you pay more to see AFL versus a second or third tier sport because it's the best sport or the most popular sport.
Oh, so, I'm surprised the same commentators are not starting by complaining that they charge more on a Saturday. Like, why should they be allowed to charge? I mean, don't you think when someone is charging $60 and they charge $35, what that mostly shows is that they didn't really understand how to price when they were charging $30. Like, there's a market-based economy that we live in and it's a supply and demand economy.
Absolutely.
And your hairdresser, I mean, by the way, the barber, it's very impressive he's got an online booking system.
Yeah.
That's surprising.
We actually owned a business called Bookwell that has now been sold to the market leader. Now most hairdressers are pretty much online, or really? Majority are. Our business, Bookwell, which we sort of started, a guy called Matt Nathan, who were the founders of it now, started this business and we sort of seed funded it.
Oh, I nearly sold a business to him. I wanted to sell it. The co-founders didn't want to sell it. Hezi Leibovich did, you know, the Hezi Leibovich deals?
Yeah. Well, Hezi bought Matt and Nathan's business.
Yeah, heavily skewed towards.
Yeah. He's a shrewd acquirer of businesses. Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to do the deal.
Yeah.
But anyway, my co-founders didn't. And I thought Matt was a very good...
Great guy. And he's actually working in the UK for Fresher, which is the market leader. Great business and could be a $10 million business. That has absolutely gone online, to answer your question, or to rebuke your statement.
I don't know what I'm talking about is what you're saying. My hairdresser uses a book with a pen and paper.
Really? A bit old school.
Yeah, but like the people that work there are not.
You look at what Fresher, which is the market leader, they're doing some really cool things now. So they're able to give finance to hairdressers to buy stuff. They can sell products on there. There's a lot of really cool stuff happening. That's a great example of technology adding value to
totally agree.
Sector.
You know the advantage of my hairdresser? Like, they even ask me every time I book for my phone number again and they write it down. Oh, there's going to be there's no chance of a data breach at my hairdresser. You'd literally have to steal the
get
book.
Robbed.
No, yeah, but like, robbed. They'd have to steal your appointment book. That's what a data breach looks like in my hairdresser.
It, Another great example of when people talk about the evils of corporations, and it's really not, it's Taylor Swift. So if you look at concert tickets, really call it even 6 months ago. So Ed Sheeran was, I think, had some of the biggest concerts ever in Australia in February and March. He was charging about $100 for, call it the lead-in, the entry-level ticket, which was a lot more expensive than it used to be in my and your day when we were growing up, but still a pretty reasonable price. Taylor Swift, generally the lowest price for Taylor Swift. Remember, you couldn't get tickets. Like, people were desperate to get tickets and couldn't get them. My chief of staff, who is married to one of the big radio guys in Australia, you'd think she couldn't even get a ticket, and she's married to one of the most powerful men in radio. So it was that hard to get tickets. So she was charging $250 a ticket. So she was charging more than double what Ed Sheeran charged. And you go, oh, Taylor Swift is responsible for inflation. She's charging double Ed Sheeran, which he was here 6 months ago. But now Taylor Swift tickets on the black market chart at double what she charged. Yeah. And there's a Freakonomics, actually, has a great podcast on this. They talk about why ticket prices are too cheap. But it's yet another example.
Because they care about their fans.
They care about
their fans. They'd rather have their fans at the concert than the richest people.
Exactly. And that's great. And that's exactly what Taylor Swift did. So she was more than double the cost. And this is going to gross $1.5 billion her concerts globally, the Eras tour. But so she's significantly increased. But she's arguably helped cause inflation, but...
Taylor Swift effect. Do you know about that?
Is this the hotels filling up and all that stuff?
As she travels around to each city, there is an inflationary jump in each city that she tours in that's directly attributed to her concerts.
And that's... So we're attributing it to Taylor Swift, but it's not Taylor Swift's fault. She's just creating economic value.
To be honest, I don't think she cares if it's her fault or not.
I don't think she does. But using Taylor Swift as a proxy for inflation is clearly misunderstanding that Taylor Swift had nothing to do with
inflation. No, I agree with you entirely.
Inflation was caused by the government's printing money for... 3 or 4 years, and during COVID, giving away money,
and also
to people having money now.
I'm sure you remember this, but there were no people available to employ. There's a labor shortage. I mean, it's eased a bit now.
Yeah, and I think it's eased a lot now.
It's eased a lot. Certain areas.
Yeah,
not in hospitality.
Oh, I think hospitality's gotten better. Like, I think I'm not in hospitality, but certainly when I see the service you get is much more efficient now. I don't think it's anywhere near.
We can ask Mr. Yum. I can tell you for a fact that the whole marketing team of Mr. Yum listens to this podcast.
Oh, really?
Because the guy that runs marketing, Bowden Westover, used to work at Catapult. He was actually one of the original superstars at Catapult, and he gets his whole team.
Well, I had Kim on my last podcast, the From Zero. She's a great entrepreneur.
I could not speak highly enough.
Yeah, fantastic talent.
So I think we were just all paying whatever we had to pay to get staff.
Yeah.
And so there was all this wage inflation going on in certain sectors of the economy. Do you go to the supermarket?
Yeah, I love supermarkets. Oh. I used to work in a supermarket for 5 years, so I'm obsessed with supermarkets.
Oh, my. I thought we would argue about this.
Oh, no.
I can't believe how good supermarkets are.
I love supermarkets.
Like,
I'm obsessed with supermarkets.
The whole of human history has been a struggle to find food, and now I can go somewhere.
It's incredible.
And it's 4 minutes from my house, and it's got more food. People are getting fat. There's so much food available. Anyway, but when you go to the supermarket, you've noticed in the last 2 years, like, the prices have gone crazy.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with, and I'm a frugal guy, so nothing I love more than logging on to Woolworths online, and they've got a tab for 50% off specials, and I'll just buy $300 of stuff that's 50% off.
I refuse to buy online.
Really?
For supermarkets. Because I love the experience.
It's so easy to browsing the shelves. Off. I love the experience. I do love that. I love doing that.
Every time
well.
I go there, I try it. Something new.
Yeah, it is. I think that, and Australian supermarkets, obviously they're a duopoly, and they get criticised. They treat suppliers badly, but as a customer experience, an incredible customer, probably the best customer experience in the world is Woolworths and Coles in supermarkets. Maybe Trader Joe's in the States is, arguably it's not a supermarket, but is a fantastic experience.
They pack your bags for you if you use not a self-checkout, if you use a person.
Yeah.
No one packs bags in the world except in Australia. You know, we know how Elbow can't say the price of bread or something. Like, they always get the PMs.
Yeah.
Whenever I hear that, it never makes me angry. It makes me sad for the prime ministers that miss out on the opportunity to go through supermarkets.
I'm obsessed with the price of stuff. I'll generally remember the price of most things in the supermarket. And
how much is the bread that you buy?
Well, I buy different bread. I buy bread from our fans. Stock or Gumtree. So we pay about $8 for bread, for an olive.
What did
bread.
That cost before COVID?
Oh, it hasn't actually changed that much. That was actually pretty similar. I don't think it's changed at all, actually. It was always expensive. This is a place called Gumtree, which is there's a few super high-end, I think it's three or four of them
now.
Would
you pay $10 for that bread?
No, still, it hasn't changed.
But I'm asking, would you?
Would I?
$10.
Probably.
Do you think most people would pay $10?
I doubt it.
$9? Like, do you think they've capped? This is my inflation question, because your point is that, I mean, I'm a bit interested in the bread that you eat, but because you're unbelievably fit. I don't know how, I mean, someone like you can eat an unlimited amount of carbs because you just run everywhere.
Flattering me a little bit.
Yeah. So, Like, I can't eat that many carbs. Like, you know, I've got to fit into pants. And so, but basically, the reason I'm asking is because of your point, which is you can't blame companies. It's about how much money there is. Because
absolutely.
When people can't afford to pay more, companies absorb the increased input costs
and
they just make less profit, right?
Exactly.
And so why do you think that $8 bread is only $8 still? Do you think people won't pay more?
I think probably there's the degree of elasticity. So when you talk about elasticity in demand, that is how much people are willing to spend up a curve. So as something gets more expensive, how many people stop buying it is a classic point of elasticity. And what you really... The best businesses are price inelastic.
People get confused. Elasticity
is bad for a company.
It means because it's like as you pull the rubber band, it gets tighter, which means fewer people can buy.
So you want the best businesses are monopolies that are inelastic. So as you put your price up, I'll say a toll road's an example, but you can take other roads. But a toll road the only way you can get to the airport is via this toll road.
Because they banned a train as part of the toll road contract.
Yeah. So you can avoid CityLink in Melbourne, for example. But let's say the only way to get to an airport was a toll road. You can just keep putting a price up and it's inelastic. Yeah. The only option is people can't fly or have to walk. Yeah. So that's a real example of something that's super inelastic. Something like fancy bread, I'd say is fairly elastic. Yeah. You get to a point, because you can buy another. The question is, how substitutable is it? So I can always buy Helga's instead of this fancy olive bread. It's good enough. You'll survive it. But I think to answer your question, I'd buy Helga's on special. I'd probably pay $2.50, $3 because it'd be sort of 40-50% off. I think the standard price would be $5.
So is it head to head if Helga's is on special?
Yeah.
You're going to buy Helga's or you're going to buy your $8 bread?
We tend to have both Helga's and the $8 bread. So we have a mix.
So if guests come over, like if I come over.
You get the fancy bread.
So I think the cost of that bread, the input costs have definitely gone up. And so that's a good juxtaposition, right? Like the input costs of that have gone up, but they feel like the market is not there, and so they can't increase their price.
And there's probably some pretty good margin on the bread in the first place.
I'm sure there is.
Cop some more margin hit. It's probably also.
But there are not many billionaires who are bakers. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Like, well, I go to IPO with the son of the founder of Baker's Delight.
Well, he's not a baker.
They were at one point.
He pays bakers.
But I'm sure they baked once.
I don't know about that.
If you once baked, you still remain a baker if you stop baking?
Well, that's a good question. Well, that's like me being a doctor. I haven't cured anyone. I've never cured anyone.
But if you own a doctor's surgery and you stop practicing, you still be a doctor.
Yeah. You know why I'm a doctor? Because I pay my registration fee every year.
Oh, you still pay that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I don't know. So you can prescribe me stuff?
Well, I definitely can't prescribe you anything because I pay a non-practicing registration. No, and you know what? The smart thing I did, I think, just to give myself props on this, is that when I said I'm not going to practice anymore, I made sure I didn't get a script pad because you can't write it for yourself anyway legally. Yeah. And I don't want people like you asking 100% me to write scripts. So I'm not managing you.
I don't have any family members who are doctors. There's one that we got about 20 lawyers in the family, not a single doctor. My mum devastated about that. My daughter said she wanted to be a doctor. She's six. Yeah. She wanted to be a doctor, and now she wants to be a fashion designer. My mum's devastated. She was the great white hope of getting a doctor in the family. sadly, lots
you can't
of
say great white hope anymore because people great don't hope. Know the, people right. don't know reference, and they just think you're being racist.
What? I don't even know where that comes from.
I think
where
it was
from?
A boxer or something.
Oh, really?
Wasn't it?
Oh, so it is racist.
All the good boxers were like African Americans, and so there was
still,
like a white
still are.
Dude. Still are. I don't watch boxing.
Let
me get back to things on your end. Did you?
Yeah. Not very well.
You tried to punch people in the head.
I didn't go in the ring. I go to boxing classes, like proper classes. What, never went in the ring though.
But people punched you in the head or not?
No. You use the pads and stuff.
Oh right.
So you
were against an inanimate object.
No, because
a lot of boxers. By the way, a lot of boxers are quite similar to inanimate objects. I just want to point.
It's actually a super hard sport to play. I hate watching it, but it's a super hard sport.
I'm sure it is.
It's tiring.
I would never have thought trying to avoid being punched in the head by a guy who spends all day trying to punch people in the head. I would never have thought that would be an easy thing to do.
But it's not hard.
Not just guys.
It's just like the fitness you need on those is incredible because it's like running. You're constantly moving. So I did it for a little while. We stopped. My wife actually was a good kickboxer as well, but we both stopped.
Really, I would like. A wife who is a good kickboxer, that's either a recipe for a happy marriage or a very unhappy marriage.
Wife's now an elite pole dancer, so she's a pretty handy sports person.
I feel like that's better.
Yeah, I think it's probably still millennial, but as she, boxing's a hard one to continue on as you get older.
So I'm going
to
finish on this bread inflation thing.
Yeah.
So the input costs go up, but your baker can't pass on the cost
because
there's price elasticity.
Yeah.
The input costs go up for the hairdresser, presumably the barber, some rent and some electricity and probably some employees.
Yeah.
But he can pass on the cost because there's much less elasticity. You're not paying $80 for a haircut, presumably.
No, and there's other people who charge $80. I don't go to them. I go to the... It also depends on, again, substitutability. So is there another hairdresser who's good enough who might be $30? I might go to them.
And Taylor Swift doesn't charge $500 for her tickets for reasons that are I would say at least as much non-commercial reasons Absolutely. As commercial reasons. And so what we're basically saying is that it's very complicated, an economy. Yeah. Like a capitalist free market economy has got lots of different pockets doing different things. And to basically just say this is the cause of whatever is not a very smart way of characterizing things, but it's good for clicks.
I think to link it back, also obviously we're a show about business and growth and startups. Link it back to if you're starting a business, what you want is a business that has a degree of inelasticity in price. So if you're in, if you start a business that is in a super competitive sector, it's hard because your margin's constantly getting squeezed. And that, we had a business called deals.com.au at one point, and
that was part of the business.
The Groupon was the big one. There was there was Scoopon and Kudo. We own most of them as part of Luxury Escapes now. Yeah. But the problem with that business was we all dealt with the same suppliers. So we're all fighting for the same supply. So when we started the business, the margins were sort of 30, 40%. Oh, how good a business is this? You're making great margins. There are other problems with the business, but you have these great margins. But then when you have 80 competitors competing for the same supplier, someone comes and goes, oh, I'll give you 10% margin. And the supplier goes, I'll take that. So suddenly the business that was a really nice profitable business becomes unprofitable because your margin. So we learned really quickly that what you wanted an element of defensibility in the business. And we have a bit more of that with Luxury Escapes because we can move a lot of volume. We've got some tech stack advantages. But what you don't want, so anybody who's listening and thinking of starting their own business is, I think you're very good at this when the business you work for is you want a degree of competitive advantage in your product as well. And that's why you love private label, because you own the product.
Yeah, that's why I only am interested in differentiated products. I will say my broken record, which is over the long term, the only way to have a great business is brand. Brand differentiation. That is the road to a great business over time.
Yeah. I think we'll leave it there. Thanks for listening and look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you for listening to The Contrarians with Adam and Adir. If you want to submit a question for the show, please send a voice recording to Adam J. Schwab at Instagram. Today's show was produced by Keelan Brown. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to give us a rating and tell your friends. We'll be back next week for our weekly analysis of all things growth and tech.